This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Europe's migrant arrivals set a new record. Air pollution chokes two of the world's largest cities. A Christmas museum evokes memories of holidays past.
I love seeing the different toys, and it definitely brings me back to when I was a kid, the excitement about Christmas.
We'll also tell you about who are the hip-hop and R&B artists topping this year's Billboard magazine list. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports an unprecedented 1 million people, most fleeing persecution and war, have arrived in Europe this year. The International Organization for Migration says the number of migrants and refugees crossing into Europe by land and sea is four times higher than in 2014. A new report released by the Geneva-based IOM says the vast majority of this year's migrants crossed into Europe by sea, with more than 800,000 traveling from Turkey to Greece. Most of them are refugees from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. International Edition's Michael Lippin spoke with Joel Millman, an IOM press officer in Switzerland, about how his organization was able to tally such a big number of migrants.
Mostly we're relying on the data from ministries and law enforcement units across the Mediterranean shoreline, Greece, Italy, Spain, Malta. Mostly we're in contact with those governments, and we get the data as soon as it comes in. We also have monitors at all the ports and the islands of Greece, not every island, but quite a lot, the big ones where migrants have been coming in this year, and also the ports in Italy where rescued migrants on the high seas are brought in for processing. So we're getting pretty reliable numbers from the agencies that are in charge of those rescues and the ones who are doing the registering in the various countries as well.
What are the main factors behind the influx of the migrants and refugees this year?
Well, the biggest is the change in the composition of refugees in the Middle East, principally Syria and Iraq. People that were staying in countries like Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, to some degree a tipping point was reached, and it just became much harder for people to remain there for a variety of reasons, and they began to follow the path. And we already had 40,000 Syrians last year came through Libya, so it was a pretty robust flow of Syrians going great distance to get to Tripoli and then get boats for Italy. That traffic largely shifted back to the Middle East, the people leaving Turkey. This year from Libya, we only had 7,000 Syrians. So we know that's moved back, and I'm sure that scale, 40,000 plus, just contributed to a much bigger number. It sort of snowballed up from that. And I don't have off the top of my head the total number for Syria, but it's something close to the 800,000 plus that have come through Greece this year.
Well, the IOM released a statement saying that a more coordinated European response is beginning to take shape. What does that response look like?
So we're not really 100% sure of how the new border patrol is going to work, some of these new law enforcement measures, but it's just this fact that so many countries are agreeing to consider different types of resettlement numbers. It may be a quota, it may not be a quota, but it's something that we're confident that our members, all 28 members of the EU are also IOM members, are working towards a solution that will work for the continent.
Well, some European nations have been setting up barriers to the migrants and refugees in recent months, or saying that they want to otherwise restrict the numbers flowing in. So what is the IOM doing to address this backlash that we're seeing in Europe to the influx?
Well, I mean, much of it is just advising governments and member states. The 28 members of the European Union, who are also our members of IOM, we act to work on perception change. We're reaching out to the media, social media, all kinds of media, to make people understand that we consider a lot of these fears manufactured or stereotypical. There's all kinds of ways that you can disarm and refuse this kind of fear over migrants coming in. But mostly we're advising people that the greater difficulty it is crossing the border, the more likely a migrant's going to turn to a criminal organization. And you're going to see the kind of tragedies that we saw this summer when 71 people were found dead in a refrigerated truck in Austria. You know, people who can't cross legally and safely risk very dangerous passages and often lead to death.
And how do you see this migrant wave continuing into next year?
Well, we don't see any immediate stop. I mean, the winters were always low traffic periods. That seems to be the case. I can only say that we didn't think last year's number would be repeated, and last year's number was quadrupled this year. It's hard to imagine even more migrants than this year coming next year, but we've learned not to be surprised.
International Organization for Migration Press Officer Joel Millman in Switzerland speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Social media is reacting to the big milestone in Europe's migration crisis. Here are some tweets. Dagenham Man at KTF 1965 comments, "Are the do-gooders too blind to see that not everyone is who they seem to be? And the migrant crisis will affect existing low-income families in Europe." Hashtag Ghana 233 at Ghana posted, "The migrant issue seems to be an unending nuisance. But can the West really continue developing 100% without them?" Courtney PB at Mostly Courtney adds, "It's selfish to be complaining about not having the new iPhone or new Xbox game on Christmas when there are families without homes." Refugee Council, a charity that works with refugees and asylum seekers in Britain, tweeted at Refugee Council, "Some perspective. More refugees are sheltered by Lebanon than arrived in Europe during 2015. And former U.S. Congressman Joe Walsh at Walsh Freedom posted, "Goodbye, Europe. Nice knowing you." You can tweet us your feedback at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views, presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar at voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
This is VOA's International Edition. Britain is deploying military advisors to Afghanistan's southern province of Helmand, where Western-backed Afghan forces engaged in fierce battles with Taliban militants on Tuesday. The British announcement came one day after a Taliban suicide bomber killed six U.S. troops near a NATO base outside the capital, Kabul, the deadliest attack on Americans in Afghanistan since August. Christopher Sneddon is a South Asia analyst with the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies. He told International Edition's Victor Beatty that Taliban militants are stepping up their efforts to capture Helmand province.
There's a very well-known Pakistani journalist called Ahmed Rashid who's written a lot about the Taliban in Afghanistan, who's now claiming that the Afghan regime is in total panic over the Taliban's current offensive and that it's not improbable that the Taliban may come back. And if they are to capture Helmand, then that would be part of that particular comeback, because that, again, is their heartland, and it will be very difficult for the Afghan forces to retake that. There's two other aspects associated with this as well. Civilian casualties this year are considerably higher than for a long period, in fact, probably the worst ever, according to some reports. And also, looking at the figures for the Afghan security forces, they're down by about 10 to 15,000. So there's some serious capability issues on the Afghan government side. They don't have air power. They have some access from foreign air power, but they don't have their own air power. And they also have some issues maintaining some of the capabilities that they've got. So they are under some significant pressure, it seems, at the moment.
The UN Security Council on Monday extended sanctions against the Taliban for 18 months. warning of increasing presence of affiliates of the Islamic State as well. Nicholas Haysom, the UN envoy for Afghanistan, said afterwards that the security situation is extremely challenging, with the most significant threat coming from the Taliban insurgency. He also said the government in Kabul needs to prove itself worthy of international support in the coming new year.
The government in Kabul does have some issues. The intelligence chief resigned a little while ago, partly over a disagreement with the president, Mr. Ghani. Mr. Ghani, I have seen one or two reports saying that he's not particularly well at the moment, which is an issue as well. They do seem to be under stress, there's no doubt about that. But in terms of ISIL, ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call this particular group, it seems that they're only at this stage in the Nangarhar area of eastern Afghanistan, and that's partly to do with controlling trade and various other things in that particular province. One of the aspects of the Taliban is that they don't want to acknowledge the caliph, because by doing so they would lose some degree of power or autonomy. They want to control Afghanistan on their own terms. So there's a bit of a power struggle, ideologically speaking anyway, between some of these Islamic elements.
That was Christopher Sneddon, a South Asia analyst with the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty. The capitals of the world's two most populous countries have something in common, and it's not something they're very proud of. Bad air. Very bad. Air quality monitoring stations in Beijing and New Delhi have displayed readings far exceeding the threshold for the highest category hazardous level. VOA's Steve Herman has details.
The Chinese capital on Monday and Tuesday was under its second-ever pollution red alert, prompting Beijing's metropolitan government to close or curtail operations at factories, pull half the vehicles off the capital's roads, and close schools. In the early afternoon on Tuesday, air quality index machines in central Beijing showed readings in excess of 400 micrograms per cubic meter for PM2.5. The issuing of red alerts, however, does not mean Beijing's air is actually more polluted than it has been in the past, says Yanzong Huang, senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations.
The reason that the municipal government decided to issue the red alert to justify more radical measures to control the pollution level. So, and then it turned out, indeed, some of the measures, like limiting the number of cars on the road, actually brought down the level of pollution.
In India's capital, after a respite about a decade ago when anti-pollution measures led to improvements, the city is again choking on air considered the worst in the world. Anumita Roy Chaudhry is executive director for research and advocacy at the Center for Science and Environment in New Delhi.
Right now, during winter, it's so visible. You can sense it, you can smell that smog.
The World Bank this year calculated that the shortened lifespans of people in India's cities due to air pollution is costing the country's economy $18 billion annually.
Studies have shown that in Delhi, every third child has impaired lungs now. If you look at the number of premature deaths that get reported from different studies in this city, that virtually works out to be one death per hour due to air pollution-related diseases.
The Delhi High Court, which previously said that living in the Indian capital was akin to being in a gas chamber, on Monday declared an emergency. Two judges of the court directed all concerned authorities to follow existing rules and reduce particulate matter levels. They also chastised traffic police for being ineffective in reducing road congestion. Across the region, according to Seton Hall University Professor Huang, authorities are still grappling with how to combat the pollution in the long run.
Even in the case of China, we've seen the top leaders themselves increasingly committed to pollution control. There's no consensus on how to effectively address the problem. And of course, in Delhi, India, you face similar challenges on how to handle that dilemma between economic development and environmental pollution.
In Dhaka, the world's fastest growing megacity, traffic congestion and smoke from brick kilns create pollution blame for killing thousands of residents every year and causing between 80 million and 230 million cases annually of respiratory diseases. A high pollution alert also prompted Iranian authorities in Tehran, Isfahan, and Iraq to close all schools for 2 days from Sunday. It was the first such order since 2010. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Still ahead, a visit to a Christmas museum. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. space agency NASA began accepting online applications for astronauts earlier this month. It's a very difficult process. Stav Ziv is a Newsweek journalist who compares getting into NASA with admission to an elite American university, in this case, Stanford. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with her about what it takes to make the potential astronaut list and how many prospects make it in.
It varies from cycle to cycle. So we took, as an example, the most recent cycle. The applications came in between November 2011 and January 2012, and they had 6,113 people apply. They took just 8. So that's an admission rate of 0.13%. So very, very tiny.
You really have to stand out in that crowd to be accepted.
Absolutely, and it takes several rounds. They narrow it down multiple times, and sort of the people who are around toward the end will actually go to Houston to do a week-long set of sort of interviews and testing. Even from that group of about 100 or 120, the people who ultimately will be selected is very, very small.
I'm sure the selection process involves quite a bit of criteria. What are some of the things that NASA is looking for?
Some of the basic criteria that they talk about in their initial call has to do with, one of them is education. So, for example, you have to have studied one of several topics in your undergraduate career. So they're looking for a BA in engineering, biological science, physical science, computer science, or math. Then they're looking for either 3-plus years of related experience or 1,000 hours of flight experience. So there are two different areas you could be applying from. And the last sort of basic piece of criteria is the ability to pass a long-duration space flight test, which has to do with sort of physical and medical characteristics.
Now, we're comparing this with getting into Stanford University, which, in the interest of full disclosure, you were a student there.
Yes.
What is Stanford looking for? How difficult is it to get into Stanford today?
Ooh. Well, the number that we were looking at was the admission rate for the class of 2018. And at that time, they accepted 5.07% of students. This sort of topic of college admissions has been a hot topic in the recent years just because of how difficult it has been, and the numbers are sort of dropping, and how hard it is to predict where you're going to end up in that game, regardless of good grades or SATs or extracurriculars. It's still difficult to know what's going to happen. And that's similar to the NASA process. They reject at least as many good qualified candidates as they accept. So the numbers are just very low on both sides.
And I would imagine the numbers even lower for somebody who went to Stanford who was accepted by NASA.
I imagine that's the case. Actually, that's a good question. I think it'd be interesting to see what kind of overlap there is.
Well, Stav, I nominate you to go into space if you so elect to.
Oh, well, I did major in history, so I don't think that's going to be possible for me, but maybe for some other Stanford alums out there.
That's Stav Ziv, reporter for Newsweek. Her article, Stanford Admittance Easy Compared to NASA Astronaut Program, is available online. She spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. The National Christmas Center brings to mind the joy and memories of Yule times past. The only Christmas museum in the world is packed with vintage toys and ornaments. Visitors from around the world come to the privately owned center in the small town of Paradise, Pennsylvania. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to one of the most Christmassy places in America.
The National Christmas Center is full of nostalgia and thousands of items reflecting the holiday spirit. This room features charming toys from different eras. Lindsay Hallman came to visit with her children.
I love seeing the different toys, and it definitely brings me back to when I was a kid, the excitement about Christmas.
The old stuff is new to her son Brody, who is just as excited.
There's lots of lights, and a lot of Christmas trees are up.
500 Santa Claus figures are scattered throughout the museum, including this North Pole workshop and an exhibit on Christmas around the world. These figurines go back to the 1800s. Museum curator Jim Morrison says Santa's clothing has changed over time.
100 years ago, he had blue pants and a red top and white fur, and that kind of developed into the red Santa that we know today.
About 3/4 of the objects in the center come from Morrison, who began collecting all things Christmas as a child.
Here is a little train that my aunt gave me when I was 3 years old. That little train started all of this here.
Now in his 70s, Morrison put his treasures into this building to share his love of Christmas with others.
Christmas was changing in America. I kind of liked the way it was when I was a little boy, so we built this through the imagination of a child. All the special things, caroling, the Christmas tree, just memories of generations.
Visitor Walter Smith wishes today's Christmas could be more like the old days.
Today it's gotten so commercial. Years ago, Christmas meant something, and it was the simple things in life back then.
He and other visitors are especially taken by the recreated Woolworth store, the first retail chain to sell factory-made goods at cheap prices. For more than a century, starting in the late 1800s, Woolworth's was the place to go for Christmas decorations and toys. For older visitors, the center's memorabilia takes them back to being a kid again. And for kids, it's a look at the joy of Christmas before they were born. Deborah Block, VOA News, Paradise, Pennsylvania.
Billboard Magazine's year-end lists for 2015 are out, giving critics and fans a chance to agree or disagree. International Edition's David Byrd sat down with the lady DJ, Shauna Renee, to talk about which artists and songs topped the R&B and hip-hop lists for the past year.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love.
Drake dominated this year. Not only did he dominate this list, which is Billboard's list of top R&B and hip-hop artists, but he's been dominating lists, Spotify lists, MTV lists, you name it. He's at the top of the list because 2015 was such an incredible year for him. He released, if you're reading this, It's Too Late, which was his album. This year, he also released a mixtape with Future. He went on tour. You know, he's just kind of been all over the place. He has this incredible video out now that everyone loves and is talking about. So he came out on top of this Billboard list of artists.
Now, The Weeknd, if you've been listening to pop music at all, right, you've heard I Can't Feel My Face. But he had 12 currently charting songs at the same time?
Yeah. Weeknd has not only dominated the R&B charts, but he dominated the Hot 100 artist charts, digital song charts, streaming charts, and then also on the R&B side, they're like these adult R&B charts, and these are kind of songs that appeal to an older audience, and he's dominating those charts as well. I mean, though this was the year of Drake, Weeknd was not far behind.
Now, we talked about some of the other folks on this list. Let's start with Fetty Wap.
So Fetty Wap is this hip-hop artist. He's kind of like what we call a trap artist. And so his song, Trap Queen, was sort of has become sort of like an anthem. And, I mean, MTV embraced him, and then all of a sudden, everyone else started to as well. And some people might consider his music an acquired taste. It certainly took me a little while to get into it. But once I did, I realized that he is actually something special. He really is, I think, unique in that he's very authentic. He talks about his experiences. And if you kind of keep it in the context of which it is being created, you understand
don't
that.
Do it for me. Now watch me whip. Kill it. Now watch me nae-nae. Okay. Now watch me whip.
There's a couple of acts that got their fame primarily through YouTube and through going viral. Let's start off with Silento with Watch Me.
Right.
And then you have I Love Memphis with Rock the Kwan.
These are dances. So his song Watch Me is a series of dances that he put together. And Rock the Kwan is a dance. So that's what makes these so special. And so he's in the gym and he's doing, like, I think he said it was maybe a minute. And then he started noticing everyone was uploading videos, doing these dances. And he said, well, let's expand this. He expands it. He puts it on YouTube. It goes viral. He gets signed. And now he's looking to 2016 to maybe be a breakout year for him.
All right. Well, what do you think? Do you have a top 10 list of acts that you followed in 2015? Send a tweet to Shauna. She's at VOA Lady DJ. And you can always log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The corrosive nature of corruption is well known. As U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has stated, corruption fuels instability and robs innocent people of their due and their possibilities. Secretary Kerry also said that as deeply rooted as corruption can be in some countries, it is not inevitable. One country that has made strides in fighting corruption is Ukraine. At a panel discussion at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington, William Brownfield, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, noted that Ukraine's Maidan Revolution, which started in 2013, was largely a public response to rampant corruption. Taking to the streets, the Ukrainian people, at the cost of 100 lives, stood up and said, "We want change." Assistant Secretary Brownfield observed that some anti-corruption measures since Ukraine's current government was elected in 2014 have been significant. For example, the government has implemented a system in which property must be registered online and government contracts must be procured online, making arrangements previously made behind closed doors public. Additionally, the government has established new rules relating to campaign finance and media ownership. Assistant Secretary Brownfield said, however, the solution to corruption is not just technical, it is also in the institutions themselves. He noted that the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, or INL, has spent $25 million on assisting Ukraine to build transparent, effective institutions. Those efforts include helping train and equip the Ukrainian Border Guard services. The Ukrainian Border Guard Service and a new National Patrol Police Force, aiding an NGO-run vetting center that will vet all police and personnel throughout the government, and supporting a new Inspector General in the Prosecutor General's office. In addition, INL is providing grants to several civil society organizations to monitor Ukraine's anti-corruption efforts and to offer recommendations for greater solutions as the government of Ukraine advances its reform efforts. But, as Vice President Biden said recently before the Ukrainian Rada, not enough has been done yet. He called for more reforms in the Office of the General Prosecutor, the judiciary, and energy sector. He pressed for more transparency in official sources of income and accountability of oligarchs. This is why the vice president announced almost $190 million in new American assistance to help Ukraine fight corruption, strengthen rule of law, implement reforms, bolster civil society, and advance energy security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.